thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Member. We will correct this issue of admissions. Okay. Honorable Members, I'm going to present a summary of the comments as we understood them, and also quickly indicate what our thinking is. We have had intensive discussions internally after studying most of the submissions. And these responses are based on the hearings we had on the 7th and 8th, and we basically prepared a summarization of what was presented. In each slide, at the top, we tried to capture the organization that made the presentation, and right at the top will be the section of the bill, mainly on the preamble, and on the right-hand column will be the response by the department. And we then went on section by section. Now, the comments on the preamble came from Disability Workshop Development Enterprises, where they felt that the preamble should actually be broadened to make sure that people with disabilities, that is, the preamble captures the essence of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, as well as Convention on 68. Now, this is something that we looked at, and it was extensively debated, because at NEDLAC we had about six conventions, including the United Nations Rights of Persons with Disability Convention. And we believe that the bill makes reference to all the conventions, especially because 3B of the bill talks to relevant international labor standards, and we were not sure as to whether you need to repeat that in the preamble. However, the legal advisor can look at it. But we also seriously looked at this, the issue around protected. Honorable Members will know that these factories were known as service products, and we came with enhanced shelter employment. And during the submissions, there was also a serious problem with shelter, and hence the terminology around protected was developed at NEDLAC level, and again, there are serious issues. When we looked at the convention, we realized that protected may be a synonym to shelter, and therefore the issue that they were raising around shelter protected is valid, and honorable members here could look into the question of what they submitted, and we are not opposed to that. In terms of the focus of the naming of this subject to be supported in order to comply with the United Nations Convention. On the definitions, the Confederation of Association in the Private Employment Sector case raised an issue around the definition being too broad, and especially around areas such as psychometric testing, etc. And they also, I think, the employment sector case raised an issue around the definition around work opportunity, that it needs, the definition is too broad. Now, in our response, the issue around employment services was defined as to include amongst others, which means that the list is not exhaustive. But later on the board members, we noticed that UNISA is raising also a point to say the youth may leave it wide open, and therefore we need to be either very specific to the needs. So, but however, there's a distinction between employment services and the functions of public employment services as defined in Section 518J and 2 of the bill. And on the question of work opportunities, we believe that the regulations will better clarify Section 10.2 of the bill. At NetMed, there was also an agreement that there is a distinction that we need to also do, and this we also discussed extensively with the drafters in the department on the level and extent of detail that goes into the bill and the regulations, because if we're not careful, we may end up also having to do what is supposed to go into regulations in the bill. And we believe that this could be best dealt with in the regulations. Again, on the definition of second constitutional rights, they wanted a definition on that is for vulnerable work seekers. At NEDAC level, we also debated this issue extensively, and the feeling was that we should not define this terminology, because if it is also used extensively in the labor relations exception, there is an understanding that we must develop. Otherwise, if you define most of the terminologies and later on as amendments in one act, you also end up having to define, end up having to amend all the rules. And if a concept is defined in other legislation, the feeling was that we should use and or adopt it. And that if it's already defined in other legislation, like I said, we need to adopt it. And this is going to be a major principle, because most of the definitions that are proposed, if honorable members were to consider what NEDNEC suggested, that is that if something is already defined in the labor relations and employment equity, the principle is whether you need to redefine it again in a subsequent legislation, or you need to adopt that principle. Disability workshops and development enterprises, they wanted a definition on persons with disabilities. Now again, this is another typical example, because this is already defined in the Employment Equity Act. There's an issue that they also raised around the Section 42, because 42.1, as is currently written, that is on the scope of the shelter employment sector. This is the one area where we agree to look into this issue and to adjust Section 42.1 so that it does not create a perception that shelter employment factors are in their own ways a dumping ground for people with disability, but rather entities that are there to also support the facilitation and reintegration of people with disability into formal employment. And the specialized employment services, again, this is one area where the state law advisors will assist us in the recrafting so that we look into the possibility of including some of those functions. Although employment services does provide for that, and the labor relations in terms of the functions of what T, that is temporary employment agencies, can do is also providing extensive information around some of the aspects. UNICEF also, this issue that I mentioned, they include to be replaced with means, I think the federal advisors who assist vulnerable workers. I have already dealt with this issue. The Construction Engineering Association basically wanted us to clearly define the obligations and responsibilities of temporary employment services. Now, in the bill, the way temporary employment services is defined under Section 1 is that it bears the same meaning as defined in the Labor Relations Act. And we also believe that this is one of the things that we have learned in the recent workshop that we had with the payments around the regulations and their systems that has to do with the registration and regulation of private employment agencies. And one of the things that we realized is that the certificates and the way we develop regulations and we looked at their regulations is that we may have to look at a number of things. Firstly, the certificate of registration to indicate the area of coverage, and in some instances we have to regulations we have to cover for the type of areas related to responsibilities and regulations. But what we have also learned is that you cannot capture everything in terms of regulations to try and ensure behavior and best practices. There are systems of codes of good practices. There are guidelines that can be developed to ensure that temporary employment agencies or services work closely and in harmony with what we're doing in the department. And the other thing that came up was in the certificate itself, and this is something that was raised on a number of cases. Just to give honourable members, although it didn't come from this presentation, but the issue has to do with if I can use an example of a car. If you buy a car before you can have the registration plate, have a permit which is paid for certain things, etc. And the issue relates to how you deal with, for instance, an agency that may meet certain requirements but may need to still provide us with additional information in order to reflect the system. And in other systems, they make provision for a provisional certificate before a full certificate. And that is quite important in order to ensure that the 60 days that we have in the legislation is not blocked up. But we'll talk to that issue when we come to the other section. The SA Board for People Practices, this was a broad comment around partnership that they believe we should establish. During the public hearings that we had throughout the country, there was an initial perception that by coming up with public employment services or strengthening certain parts, as honorable members may know, that public employment services currently provided for under the Skills Development Act, is that we're going to drive the private employment agencies underground, or we know the debates around the venue, etc. But engaging the APRO and CAPES, which are the biggest federation that register and organize these people, we are working very closely, and we've done quite a number of things in the regulations currently under the Skills Development Act, is that the very same issue that we are sitting across is what they are also able to deal with in terms of and there is no intention of basically not working with the private employment agencies in this regard. So the question of the partnership comment that was made has no impact. What you're basically saying is that we are already putting that into practice, and I'm sure Kate and Axel could testify to that around how we're working with them on that issue. And practical examples that one can find are those instances where, for instance, companies would require specialized and highly skilled people that we would not necessarily have in our database. In those instances, we would also normally contact APSO or CAPE to look into their database. But then once we do that, we make it clear to the employer that dealing with the organization, they must also know that for treatment purposes, the organizations would be entitled to charge for the services. This is where these organizations would normally go out there and look for a person like Mkhaliphi, recruit them from the Department of Labor and place them with a ULEF alumni and successful placement. They would then charge ULEF alumni for placing Mkhaliphi, but that becomes the relationship between Mr. Mkhaliphi and APSO, and the department is not involved. What we can do is to negotiate for the waiving of those fees on behalf of the process that APSO would be embarking upon to recruit Mkhaliphi. And a lot of similar practices that are happening. And in some instances where there are areas of mass recruitment, agencies where they believe that they cannot make money, they would normally refer and mass such applications to the department to also take over that function, because it's not a lucrative method for them to operate. So we took that as a comment, and there are conventions around how partnerships can be developed between the private and public and working relationship, and such good practices are things that we used during the public hearings, and there are also ILO conventions that speak to that. Solidarity, basically, this was a bit of a statement on questioning the whole need to have this bill. But four points that we want to raise is that employment services is currently governed under the skills development. So in fact, there is law really in the country. And even before the Skills Development Act, honorable members may know if the honorable members go to the sections of the repealed act of the Skills Development Act. What happened when the Skills Development Act was passed in 1998 is that the Career Guidance and Placement Act and the Manpower Training Act of 1981, including all the self-governing territories, so-called Manpower Development Acts, and those that were in the TBV states, were all repealed to come up with the Skills Development Act. So it's a concept that has been there for years. It's just that the emphasis and the management was sharpened in Skills Development Act and the integration in short. The provision of ES is also in various UN and ILO conventions, and we can submit those, we table those at NEDLEC, and stakeholders by virtue of their participation at NEDLEC and in the ILO are very familiar with those conventions. And cabinet and a whole other stakeholders saw the need. On the University of South Africa, on the purpose of the Act, the issue that they were raising was basically to say that we are only talking about facilitating access to training for workers, and that this may create the impression that only practical subjects should be part of the task, and to do away with the perception we should include tertiary education. Now we concur with the proposed edition, and honourable members may also want to look at the including the skill, the state law advisor, the Skills Development Act, where to deal with this problem of trying to distinguish between tertiary education, because you may also have other issues around FETs and basic education. That the concept of education and skills development was totally used, and we wouldn't live with any of those. Section 5 on public development services is at 10 for people practices. The issue that they were raising was that this was poorly worded, and that there is no definition of worker in the bill. Again, the principle of the definition already covered in the other act applies, and we believe the state law advisors can check on the dusting. And the second issue they raised was the overlap with SAPA. Now, we don't believe that overlap on its own is a problem. SAPA has one office which is situated in Pretoria, and the department operates in 126 labor centers, 72 visiting homes, and that is 72 visiting centers, and a whole range of visiting points where we go 1 day per week. Now, the question that arises is if workers come for advice on careers or work-related information, must they be sent to Pretoria Center? And we debated this issue of basic education, higher education, SAPA, and all that. And within the team that is looking at career development, which we are part of, there's broad agreement and a very clear distinction that was made that the DHET and Department of Basic Education in the schooling system would normally provide vocational guidance. This is where this is a subject that is offered to the children during the students during school hours and so on. And there are different models that are there. And there's also a very clear understanding on the DOL employment counseling that is done in tests that we conduct at labor centers. We also have national ones, and there's also an understanding around the role of SAQA in providing information, that is career information, on subject choices that people can follow in case they want to pursue a specific qualification, and also the whole question of setting standards for counselors. So at that level, between ourselves, DHET, basic education, there is no confusion around the usage of terminologies and areas of overlap. Section 5, again, department takes raised an issue around the capacity of the department in order to deliver. And CAPES is very familiar with other systems in other countries, including the resources that these countries have. And we believe that the comment is not been on the bill, but it's just raising an issue around capacity. And capacity is something that we believe is something that we have at different levels, and it can be improved. It's not sufficient, and currently we are involved in a separate process with National Treasury regarding the resources to implement the ESP. This process is normally done with every bill. Once a bill goes to cabinet, you have to clearly outline the resource implications, and we believe that the bill also provides a section around the funding and the issue around the funding to implement a bill. And we believe that if we can get certain synergies correct, such as alignment with the unemployment insurance fund, the compensation fund, and I'm sure honorable members during the study tour to Germany, the relationship between unemployment, what is the unemployment insurance. In fact, they no longer have unemployment, they have an employment agency because they moved away from the insurance concept a long time ago. And the synergy between the employment insurance aspect and employment services, and you do not get access to the financial support if employment exists, and if you cannot avail yourself of employment, and if you avail yourself of employment, the need for you to get a financial assistance falls away, etc. So we believe that that is one area that we're working on, and as the unemployment insurance amendment will come to Parliament, honourable members would look to see the alignment. We've already done it in terms of the current alignment and in discussion with the national treasurer. Section 5, again, people with disability raised a serious omission on the mechanism to fund assistive devices. Now, for persons with disabilities. Now, the number of things here, first is that the assistive devices is provided for in terms of the State Development Act, NSF in particular, for basically making sure that people can access their learning. There are a lot of people who previously under the Career Guidance and Placement Act used to access these services from the Department of Labor. Basically, what we used to do was to buy in computers, braille, provide classes and so on to assist with the integration of people with disability. Now, with the Skills Development Fund and the National Skills Development Fund in place, that function was provided for under the NSF. Now, with the transfer of the National Skills Fund to the Department of Higher Education, the department could not continue to provide such a service because the means to do so no longer exist, and there are issues around the extent to which the Department of Higher Education is keen to look really at this issue, and we have again engaged them on this issue. However, on Section 6.1 of the ESP, we also provide for work schemes. Now, honorable members, if you look at the strat plan of the department, you notice that we get an allocation over and above for shelter employment, money that we give subsidies to organizations of people with disabilities, the disassociation and so on, including organizations that came to make presentations here. This is something that was inherited under the Career Guidance Replacement Act, and we still do it, and our agreement with Treasury was that they needed this provision in order to justify continued funding, including the increase of financial means for us to look at these organizations. There are 300 organizations that operate slightly different from sheltered employment sectors funded by social development, but there are also 50 that continue to draw funding from the Department of Labor, where we subsidize their running cost for the reintegration of people with disability into the mainstream. And currently, the compensation fund in the rehabilitation program for people injured on duty, they believe that whilst their focus is on medical and all those other areas, they believe that this function should now be transferred to employment services. Hence, we had a provision around the funding from the compensation fund. Although the reference section says unemployment insurance, which we think should be corrected. So this was mainly aimed at ensuring the reintegration of people into people with disabilities in employment, and we believe that that provision will also assist us under the employment services to continue to provide such services and programs. The only problem that we are sitting with honorable members at the moment is that the traditional organizations, some of which were here last time, remain the beneficiaries of the current allocations, and the issue treasury is that we must open up to give other disadvantaged organizations of people with disabilities to also access those funding and do away with you know, long-standing arrangement that has been there to favor well-established organizations of people with disabilities. But then this provision will broaden that, and it will, and even for this year, we have also given them a notice that this will be the last time we allocate funding. We are going to put adverts, and all other organizations will apply, and there will be a normal process of adjudication and allocation of funds. The Ministry of Finance in the British Economic Development and Tourism, the same case, raised an issue around basically that by establishing public employment services, we are going to compete with the private sector and are going to drive more private businesses out of business. I don't know whether this was the reason why you were not coming.
That was the reason, because the noise.
No, Mr. Mukherjee was waiting for a call from the minister.
For his deployment.
From the president. It's allowed.
But thanks for the permission. Honorable Chairperson, I think the issue raised by the economic development, like we said, was basically questioning also the existence of public employment services. And we believe that in all instances that we have, including the convention, it is the duty of the state to intervene in terms of ensuring protection of vulnerable workers and to assist them to enter into employment. And that the coexistence of public employment services and private employment agencies is already classified into the budget in the bill and in the conventions that we have adopted at different levels. Construction, that is the Constructional Engineering Association, questions again the capacity of the department, and again the comments have not been on the bill, and we have already spoken on the issues that we are doing around enhancing the capacity of the department, and currently we are already providing those services. Section 6, the Cape Chamber of Commerce there raised it was broadly a comment questioning why introduction of schemes, because in their view they look good, does not produce results, and mainly citing the TLS. Now, at a broader level, employment schemes are measures necessary in cases of high employment for any state to intervene. And we have very good experience in South Africa, if one can cite the public works programs, the Working for Water, the range of schemes that the department used to fund under the National Skills Fund that were mainly targeting unemployed workers. And some members may also remember under the previous government, the Lay Baba Roo schemes, where people used to get 10 rand a day. Under the NSF, in fact, we had actually made sure that the allocations are in line with the ministerial determination, and we conducted schemes of that nature throughout the country. And in fact, last week, the Minister of Labour received a formal letter from the Minister of Higher Education that they believe that some of these schemes in taking over are not education, and they want to renegotiate the transfer back of some of those schemes including the reallocation under the National Peace Fund for the department to continue to deliver those, because there's been a vacuum since the actual transfer. We ceased to do those in 2009, and I think Mr. Mandy was basically saying, you know, FHs cannot continue with those, and the minister has tasked us to engage with the side. On job retention, the issue on the training layoff, basically what we are saying is that training layoff came as some kind of a reaction to global crisis, and in the bill, the provision assists us to have a legislative framework that will actually provide and address the problem. Now, issues around the failure of the TLS partly has to do with the whole question of responsibilities, because currently the responsibilities were everywhere, and hence one of the things that contributed to us higher education saying this we can't do was precisely because you were dealing with, you know, retrenchments and all those interventions, and the responsibility was in higher education, but the CCMA, I'm sure in the different presentations that we have had, they've been very much involved in assisting companies to try and reach an agreement. But because we don't have the mechanism, we have had that legislative function around that. Busa also pointed out, and believed that this was a mistake that was done in the bill, that the provision under 7.1 suggests that the job retention schemes are mainly meant for protected employment enterprises, and we believe that this was a mistake, and that it should be deleted, because the concept covers a whole range of workers. So protected employment enterprises, as it appears under 7.1, should be deleted. We compare with that later on. COSATU also called on 7.1 to be amended, because they believe that the scheme should not be discussed at the Employment Services Board level, but rather at NEDLAC. And we raised this issue during the briefing on the disagreement at NEDLAC, and honorable members may have to assist us on the ground. But the issue is that if there's appropriate wording that can capture what they're saying, maybe we'll look at that. But the second point is that in our understanding, in terms of the NEDLAC Act, any matter that is of a policy nature in any way has to go to NEDLAC. Once it's settled, it is given to appropriate structures to look at the implementation. And people that are going to serve at board level are nominated through NEDLAC structure. So the issue here is how the constituencies link and work together with their representatives on the Employment Services Board, rather than to say you discuss issues having the same constituencies and then you have different people at the employment at NEDLAC who may not even understand the issue to discuss the same issue at the same time. So we believe that this issue can be settled in terms of, that is, by addressing the mandating and relationship issues, and also adopting the principle that any major policy issue, any in terms of the NEDLAC, has to go there. And the issue that we are aware of that they raised was this issue that they wouldn't want the Employment Services Board system to set standards that may end up in displacement of existing employees in the workplace and so on. But the Basic Conditions of Employment Act provides for the Employment Conditions Commission to set those standards for vulnerable workers, including for people in learnership and so on. So those matters, especially those that relate to conditions of employment will not go if it's neglect, because we already have the employment conditions commission to address those issues. So we will still have to see what are the policy issues that will have to be elevated at that level. On the case also on the question of employment of foreign nationals, there was a view that A2 that is the section could also encourage or drive xenophobia, and they put in a number of practical questions around how South Africa should deal with skills shortage. Now, we believe that section 8, 2A and B provides for the processes to be undertaken in the recruitment of foreign workers, and the regulations could best clarify the process. Again, the SABPP wanted us, or wanted the Labour Portfolio Committee, to consider inclusion of a term that is a rider that basically gives companies operating internationally to have a general permission from the minister to transfer into positions in South Africa of their foreign employees. Now, that issue, we don't believe that it belongs here in the Employment Services, because it is already covered under the Immigration Act around the intra-company transfer of workers, and the state law advisors can check on that issue to advise honorable members. The Center for Constitutional Rights basically was saying that we may not be complying with the constitution or the regulation is unjustified, is just unjustified and maybe unconstitutional, because it provides preferential treatment to South African workers at the expense of foreign nationals. Now, again, Vodacom raised this issue around duplication with the Immigration Act. So there are two issues that we wanted to raise here. The first one is that the definition of foreign national means an individual who's not a South African citizen or does not have a permanent residence permit. But the minute a person has those permits issued, etc., we don't believe that the bill in any way discriminate against those people, because those things do not apply. Any foreign national who has a resident permit will be treated like a South African citizen, and the state law advisors can advise on that issue. Center for Constitutional Development, again, I think they raised an issue around us impacting on those employers that are already having illegal workers, and that we will be disrupting their operations when we affect these workers. Now, as parliamentarians, we believe that people are honestly, accepting that they are embarking on an illegal activity. Now, already the Immigration Act is very clear, and we don't believe that we should be duplicating around this area, because employing an undocumented migrant worker is an illegal act, and the Immigration Act has the necessary penalties to address this issue. And we realize that in Schedule 3, there's an infraction of this as a penalty under the Employment Services. And Homeoffice drew our attention to that issue, and we proposed that employment of foreign nationals be removed from the schedule of offences, because it is already covered for or provided for under the Immigration Act. We also grouped comments from the South African Institute of Race Relations, Ministry of Finance, and AFSA. And the issue that they were raising around the employment of foreign nationals was that the section can be too onerous to companies that want to employ foreigners, and that there's a parallel system that is being introduced to that of Home Affairs. Now, there are a number of issues here. Firstly, the department is serving on the immigration board, and this action was extensively discussed with Home Affairs. Home Affairs is of the view that migration is becoming complicated and it's a labor issue, and no longer that they would get involved in so far as being asked to give or not to give a permit. But they believe that the mechanisms and the details with regard to the permit itself, the Department of Labor should handle. If it's trade, the Department of Trade and Industry should handle those. If it's health, the Department of Health should handle those. And we should just give them advice. If, for instance, if it's a World Health Organization passport around malaria or whatever, the Department of Health is best place to say people from these countries can be accepted in South Africa on condition that they have immunization or, you know, this health passport, etc. That's what Home Affairs said to us. So increasingly, and currently we are working with, I mean, Home Affairs only grants corporate visas to bring in people from foreign countries on the advice of the Department of Labor, because they believe that that's our function and not their function. And they are reviewing the current act, and I'm sure I think we did appear jointly before this committee and the Immigration Committee with Deputy Director General McKay, where this issue was extensively discussed during our presentation and the problems that we were having. And in suspension from tomorrow until Friday, we'll be having a workshop as a SADC region and jointly between the Ministers of Labour and Home Affairs to try and deal with this problem as a region, because it is becoming very, very complex than what we initially thought. And there's a very, very serious problem that is arising through Mozambique because of the border management and around the issue of the pen on the Mozambican side, which has now affected the whole SADC region, that the heads of state have instructed us to try and come up with a solution and to table a proposal in the next 2 months within the SADC head of state meeting to try and deal with that problem. So it is becoming a major issue. And there are recent developments around migration that is moving from Central Africa to South Africa as a destination, and Italy as a destination. And hopefully after the 3 days we may be able to come up with a proposal to deal with that. But the essence of what I'm saying is that Ministries of Interior and Home Affairs within the SADC region believe that this is no longer their issue, and Ministry of Labour should increasingly take responsibility to address the problem. UNISA raised an issue around employment of also foreigners, and again the comments are the same. Let me not repeat that. And again, we clustered comments around reporting on vacancies and filling of positions from all those organizations. But basically, the issue that we're raising was that having to report on vacancies is onerous, and the department will take time looking at the fact that it's likely to arise to respond on the application by companies, and it may impact on their ability to fill positions within a certain period. Now, this was extensively debated at NEDLEC, and that is the reason why we changed the must that was in the initial bill to make to provide for a situation or a scenario where the Minister of Labour, whilst he or she is not compelling companies to register vacancies, that the minister reserves the right if the situation in some instances or in some categories does not improve to evoke the exception. In fact, this is also already law in terms of, I think, section 26 or 24 of the Skills Development Act. It's already there under the Skills Development Act. So this section was taken as is under that act. And that we also believe that employment services internationally and everywhere, their competitive edge is on expertise, on the response time, on quality of service, and already on the cost reduction to employers, etc. And currently we've seen it. We started with very few employers utilizing the system without having to compel them. And currently we can give honorable members examples of big projects such as Kusile, Nidupi, the waterbed mines. In fact, for the last 3 weeks, the majority of officials in the labor centers in Limpopo are working from one center to assist in the massive recruitment of people to work in the various coal mines that have opened in the Limpopo region. So employers are coming because they believe that the system can assist them, and working closely with the local chiefs and so on in the mass recruitment at no cost to employers. And we believe that as long as the large number of unemployed people are actually getting into employment, that's what we need. And I think there are areas that we wanted to strengthen, that before these people are recruited, they are extensively given orientation around their labor rights. Our career counselors are doing it, but it's not sufficient. And this is something that we have to address internally, because people go into all these areas already knowing what their rights, and employers also appreciate it, that they also know their obligation. One of the problems, honorable members, in terms of the current military, was that some of the contractors work outside of the framework, and they never took time to familiarize themselves with the labor relations dispensation of the country, and hence we are having a serious standoff and the current debacle in places like Nairobi. And we've had extensive discussion with the public enterprise that the recruitment and filling of vacancies, if you manage it in a particular way and also provide orientation to employers, especially foreign ones, on our local labor legislation, you can go a long way in terms of avoiding some of the problems that are involved in the problem. Section 11, the only issue raised was around the employment information disclosure, and the issue there was that we need to make sure that we work together with various institutions in collecting data. That we welcome. Section 12 on financing of public employment services. The issue there, maybe we did not have the common line, but our understanding is that the objection was around monies which are allocated for specific purposes, and that should be used for maybe I need to skip that and go back to that to the submission, and can come back, because we struggle to capture what the issue was, because we know that from MedMed the disagreement on the issue of funds. Okay. Yeah, I remember the issue. Yeah. There were two issues. The one was that money for UIF should not be used for employment services or for compensation funds. And the issue at NEDLAB was that if you are facilitating and growing the base for employment, which in turn multiplies the contribution to UI, then you cannot say that should not be the case, because internationally labor market activation programs and institutions such as the UI are increasingly getting involved in that area instead of remaining at any job. There was also another side issue that came. It didn't come out of this submission, it came in an earlier submission where they were suggesting massive registration application funding for private employment agencies. And the issue here was also to protect our membership base so that small and medium enterprises that do not meet the threshold should also not come into the fore. So this issue never came out of NEDLAC or any other agencies, but it came from case. But also I think it goes back to the question of the competitive advantage that a public employment services will have vis-à-vis the temporary employment agency, because they believe that this will give the public employment services an upper edge over them and it will drive them out of business. The South African Institute of Race Relations, again, I think it was a similar issue. And basically, we believe that it also goes back to that issue of defining the purpose and the scope of the private employment agency. On the registration and certification of the private employment agency, again, UNISA and Vodacom raised this issue around deregistration. That is, if a company is registered under the Companies Act and it is deregistered under the Employment Services Act, does it mean that it ceases to function? Now, we want to draw a distinction that the company is registered under the Companies Act to operate in line with that act. But insofar as performing employment services functions, it will have to be registered under this act. Now, the deregistration, therefore, would mean that nothing stops them to continue to operate as a company under a private employment company act. But insofar as the labor relations and this act, and for those purposes, are concerned, they will be excluded from performing those functions because under the employment services rule, they have to be registered for their purpose. Another issue was around the confidentiality of information, and we believe that the state law advisor can assist in the drafting process. UNIS also raised the question of under 71B that any other relevant information might create uncertainty on the information that should be included, and in order to limit possible instances where companies may unintentionally end up involved in criminal activity, that we look at the rewarding of that, and we believe that the state of justice can assist us on that. The Cape Chamber of Commerce commented on the cancellation, and now again it is partly into what I said under the Companies Act. MUSA and the South African Institute of Race Relations also believe that the cancellation may also impact on small enterprises, and they also had an issue around the powers of the register and the review, and also on what happens during the transition in case the certificate is cancelled. Now, we believe that the problem rests partly by an insertion of the word provisional certificate. And honorable members, this has to do with the issue that I've raised around a cap that you can have that is new or that you are still repairing that allows you to drive, but then you know that the permit that you have is temporary until you get a permanent permit. So we believe that we should make provision for a provisional certificate in order to deal with part of the problem that they were raising there. Because as we have it, it's either you have a certificate or not. and it may be difficult to deal with those organizations or instances of additional information. The Cape Chamber of Commerce on the composition of the EF board, the first comment was just it's a broad comment around the function, and basically it's questioning the need for such a board and its function. But I think the other issue that was raised was the inclusion of the experts in private employment services to be included in the board. And the community also, especially disability, also raised the issue of community constituencies not being represented. And I think this one to productivity the composition of the internal services. So the last one should not be on this slide. But our response is that the board has been agreed as an extension to ensure social partner involvement, and that section 21.1 provides for industry experts, and we would want to urge those experts in the private employment agency to take it as a responsibility to convince BUSA to be the nominated representatives to represent BUSA in the ES board, as opposed to extending the current composition. BUSA also have touched on this issue for the type of the constitution. The issue that we wanted to raise there was that I think BUSA wanted NEDLAC to be the body that appoints the board and not the minister. And what we're saying is that there are two different things here. The first is that the bill already provides for NEDLAC constituencies to do the nomination. And this is consistent with all the boards that we have in our labor legislation, be it UI board, be it Employment Relations Commission, etc. But the minister is the ultimate person who does the actual appointment. In the very, very, very rare instances where the minister overruled constituencies in terms of an appointment, unless the member so appointed does not comply with the provisions of the constitution, that is, if they've been involved in acts of or the criminal or whatever, and in those instances, it is the duty of the minister to say, in most cases, a review. And some instances where we know where the minister intervened was if the nominations of the representatives did not provide a balance in terms of gender and so on. And in those instances, the minister referred nominations back to say, look, I want a balance in terms of gender representation in the board. So we believe that the issue is not it's not a major issue that is worth considering. Disability on the composition of the board also raised an issue around representation. And we believe that, again, the bill makes provision under 21.1(c)(3) for participation of community, and that it should be their responsibility, like in NEDLAC, to convince those social partners to be the representatives of the constituency. However, we believe that in the management and dealing with the current short-term employment factories, in the management committee and in the business case, certainly the Ministry for Women and People with Disability played a major role. And we believe that when we establish such a management committee, although not provided for in the Act, but as part of the governance of the SEF, we are going to do that. And we believe that then we should have more representation of people with disability to guide us on a range of things and be sensitive and sympathize us on a number of aspects relating to those factors. Constitution of Employment Services, UNISA, again, we believe that I think the issue there was just the timing. That is that we are asking they both be established and to function, and later on to have a constitution. And basically what they are requesting or sensitizing us to is that we should, the stable advisors should look at a possible way of either getting the minister to either through regulation publish a constitution that will allow the functioning of the board, or you may end up having a board that cannot function because it doesn't have a constitution. And there the stable advisors can assist us. It is different way of productivity of South Africa, because in the transitional provision, there is provision that allows the current constitution to be deemed to be the constitution of productivity, as I said, because you are moving into a transition, and the same applies to CEF. All rights, obligations, and liabilities that will have will be automatically translated to supported implement enterprises on the day they've been signed. So you won't be starting from the scratch. But on the internal services board, they are just saying we need to look at the issue. Dissolution of the board, Cakes was questioning the power of the minister, but we believe that 26(1) and 2 clarify the circumstances under which the minister can dissolve. Disability, again, membership of Productivity SA, they wanted representation there, and at NEDLEC there was extensive discussion. And at that level, the agreement was that, and this applies also to the Labour Market Chamber, that the issue of representation of community in general, not only people with disabilities, on Productivity SA may not be appropriate, and in terms of the current legislation, that is how it is structured. And social agreed on that at the level. On the constitutional productivity SA, again, the same issue was raised by UNISA, but we believe that the transitional provisions, Schedule 2, subsection 31, addresses the problem that UNISA was raising. Functions of protected government enterprises. Now, the first point there that we want to raise was that I think I covered the question of shelter protected. We fully agree. We need a new name that is not in violation of the United Nations, and we believe that Section 32 should be amended accordingly. The other issue was on offences. Mainly, this is a contradiction. On one hand, the fines that we are talking about are 50,000, and we have been told that this is draconian and it is criminalizing the law. And in fact, to be honest, honorable members, we are very worried that if you look at the fines in the employment equity, some employers simply budget for this amount of money, so that once you pick on them, they can simply pay and get you dismissed. We're very concerned because the fines are low. Section 49 talks about 50,000 for a range of all those offenses. Small companies may feel it, but big companies, you know, that's nothing. And that is why the employment equity is going to that extent of extensively amending their fines to the highest so that we can try and enforce compliance. Now, there we look forward to your guidance on that issue because you are dealing with legislation. Section 50 fines are much more better because they talk about a fine and a prison term. And the unfortunate thing is that currently those are restricted to offences under Section 51 and not necessarily those in Schedule 3 of the bill. Regulations, the issue that came from Cape there,
was again questioning the power of the minister to make regulations, and again UNISA also raised the question of unlimited power given to the minister as well. But I think with social partners and so on, firstly there's an agreement on the role of the board, and that you need to establish the body to provide regulations. That's the detail that is difficult to do in terms of the law and the state. But secondly, we did indicate that we have seen from other countries codes and guidelines of good practice. Not everything is going to be done in terms of the regulations. And the other thing is that the regulations that are to be developed, they don't necessarily get developed by the Internal Services Board and then submitted to the minister and automatically become regulations. It's a long and extensive process where this regulation has to be published for public comment, public consultations with the ES Board will have to oversee. But also the regulations have to be submitted to state advisors for certification to check compliance with the principal act. So the assertion that the minister may be given arbitrary power to determine regulations at the disadvantage of other entities is not necessarily the correct one in our view. And the state advisors can also comment on the UNISA assertion. Lastly, on Schedule 3, WUSA was of the view that we need to talk to the issue of maximum fines per offense. Now, the original bill had different rates for different fines, and the current formulation suggests 50,000 as a maximum that the magistrate, that is the labor court, can impose. I think the issue is that we need to avoid a situation where 5,000 can be less than the maximum, and the labor court can impose that. And the question is, you know, on what basis can you argue whether it's appropriate or not, and whether that is or will not impact on the compliance, and just a lot of cases that will not be finalized. And we believe that, like we said, penalties for permitting foreign workers should not be that heavy because it's provided for under the Immigration Act already. And 52 outlined penalties. And on that note, thank you. So, I'm not to everyone. Thank you, Chairman.
Issues with regard fundamentally to people living with disabilities. You talked about the preamble, that they should be highlighted in the preamble, and I wasn't sure whether the department implied that they would look into that. Also section 21 and 33. What I heard was that the department's position, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it's the responsibility of disabled to convince the community component of NEDLAC that disabled be represented within NEDLAC. And I'm a little bit concerned about that because fundamentally, if disabled are not represented effectively within NEDLAC, all of these compositions of boards and that are decided in NEDLAC are not going to represent disabled. I mean, fundamentally, NEDLAC has agreed that 2% of the workforce should be disabled, and yet both the private and the public sector have failed to implement that. So I think it's important that this government defends the disabled people living with disabilities and that the department steps up to the plate and puts the interests of disabled people first, in particular with regard to this proposed legislation. Because if we don't do it, nobody's going to do it. So thank you, Chair.
Honourable Madam.
Thank you, Chair. I take the points that were made during the presentation about definitions, but I would believe that concepts that we use need to be defined, even if they are defined in other law. I take the point that we cannot have different definitions, but I do believe that when I pick up the bill, it's going to tell me what I'm looking at when it says unemployed, for instance, or if it says disabled. It shouldn't mean something that I decide on my own. I'll defer to the law advisors, but I believe even if it's the same, you know, definition in the Labor Relations Act, the basic condition, in fact, that's what it should be, but it should also be defined in this law itself.
Thank you. I think the we'll see when that time comes, when the state law advisors have reworded some of the things in order for them to be clear as per what the presenter was suggesting. I think on the issue of people with disability, in particular in relation to their representation in bodies like NEDLAC. I think it's an issue that has to be dealt with in terms of the NEDLAC Act, because there's a NEDLAC Act which I assume that constituencies in NEDLAC are defined in that piece of legislation. So I think it can be better attended to there. But I think the point that Honorable Williams raised,
the president is calling now.
Yeah.
It was the minister here.
No, in fact, the president and the minister, they want to be sure whether he fear, they don't trust him.
So, Chair, I think the issue on the board, it would be difficult to reflect on the act as to what kind of people who must sit in the board. But I think if then the board will be the responsibility of the minister, I think is for us to persuade the minister that in looking at the appointment of members of the board, she must also look at how to cover people with disability in general and link it with the government policy in terms of what I know. To be in the board doesn't mean that you are employed, because the 2% is in relation to employment in the public service in the main. And there are other areas of accommodating people with disability in terms of the employment with the health. So I think that, I think we can't reflect everything in a legislation, but some of the things is the minister can deal with. The just on this issue of the layoff schemes, which some have commented on, I think we as a committee we have identified witnesses about this, and it became clear to us that employers didn't want to use the layoff schemes in order to avoid retrenchment. So they wanted to retain workers, even if government through NEDLAC has tried to put measures in place that workers are not retained. Hence then, even when we're assessing of what has been the result of the layoff schemes, and then we said what is lacking now is a legislation to make sure that once companies want to retrench, there must be legislation that forces them to use schemes like this. But in the nutshell, Chairperson, I think the department has been clarifying. In this presentation for me, it was to clarify certain things that were raised by those parties who made submissions, in order for us now, when we apply our minds as committee, and we apply our minds knowing that they have clarified certain issues that were raised. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks, Honourable. Honourable, there's one, is your hand up. Come again. Oh, thank you. Honourable Khanad. Okay. I think we should move on. Like I said here when I opened, that the legal team will do the formulations, and we are going to go through the process that we went through when we dealt with the other legislations. I don't need to repeat what the process is.
I think with the other legislation, our colleagues won't do what they've done if they want to research. They won't run away to be beaten in the democratic process.
Chain them to their chairs. You can tell us what you've started now. This is unintended consequence.
I was in the media, the backdrop before, they had their own runaways in the day.
Remember who did with their sheep?
Yeah, they were the part of the deadlock, right?
Honorable colleague,
Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Mr. Mukalibi.
Thank you, Chair.
Comrades, yeah. All titles, yeah.
Is he Nusa? His name is Nusa.
Thank you, Chair. Our response is on the public hearing that and the submission that we made on employment equity. The first one is around definitions. There was a comment from HRCP and Center for Constitutional Rights. The comment was they are questioning the amendment to the definition. Section 1B, remember, now clarify who is designated, who are designated groupings. It's those who were citizens prior to 1994 and those who are not citizens and have no citizenship because the apartheid government refused them a citizenship. It's got those two legs. Now, the other issue that they are raising there, they say that this must be clarified because it could mean inclusive of black of people only now who are becoming citizens. And we're saying that's correct. I mean, it's doing two things. It's saying that the red grouping are those who were citizens prior to 1994, black, African, Indians. And those who became citizens after 1994, but who can show that the reason they became citizens after 1994 is because the African government, for whatever reason, refused them citizenship. It blocked them. They can show that they've applied in 1960, but because they were Zimbabwean in this case and African made, the apartheid government did not process those applications. If they can show that, then, and they can show that they now only got citizen after 1994, they can be regarded as designated groupings if they can show that. The other thing that we're trying to clarify here is we believe that it's unfair for designated grouping to include all foreigners who come in from their countries, who have all the opportunities in their countries, but exclude white males who have been born in South Africa. Because the law as it stands now, it excludes white males. And that's, we're not changing anything. But we're saying we've got to compare that to why should then an African man who was born in Egypt have more rights than a white male who was born in South Africa. And that's what we're trying to do here. And that's the loophole that we try to close in this area. And most of the comment, if you read on the comment, of all the people that have raised this area, they are now worried that companies are not going to be able to bring in foreigners and reflect them as translation within those companies. And that's what's intended to do in the first place. Therefore, we don't think that there's anything incorrect. That's the intention of that amendment. It's intended to also give an opportunity for those who get citizens after 1994. The next area that they are raising on this issue is that the definition, because it excludes foreigners who came in after 1994, could be unconstitutional. We will not agree with this. If that could be unconstitutional, therefore the exclusion of whites should be unconstitutional also, because it's so different. The amendment that we're making that exclude those that become citizens after 1994, if they cannot prove that they were disadvantaged by apartheid, is unconstitutional. Then the whole act will be unconstitutional, because the whole act exclude, as I said now, basically white males. If therefore the issue, there's an issue of constitutionality, it's not related on that issue only, it could be related to the whole act. And we believe that the right in the Constitution, on Section 9, all the right in the Constitution can be limited by legislation. And this is what this legislation has been done. The next area, Professor Darcy Dutoit raised two issues. One is around this issue of defining discrimination, that was the definition of discrimination. This issue, Professor Dutoit raised it at length to labor. Labor raised this issue. There was a long debate on this issue at NetLink on whether should discrimination be defined. Now, the issue of discrimination, the definition is, definition can be good, definition can be bold, can be bad. And the parties at NetLink felt that if you define discrimination as is required, the tendency of limiting a definition itself. That is why in the Employment Equity Act, it is opted for the code of good practice on how to deal with discrimination. And in that code, it gives example and areas in terms of what discrimination is. It is as wide as possible. And the Netlag parties felt that they don't want to define discrimination and end up with a narrower provision of discrimination. They want discrimination to be as wide as possible in discrimination. And that's the unintended consequences sometimes of a definition. This is linked to the same issue on disability, that we need to define disability in terms of the law. And I think that what members will need to do when we debate these issues of definition and of disability, we've got to have the codes, the both codes, because there is a code on employment equity that deals with disability, and it explains the issues around disability. And I think the advantage with that is that if there's any other disability that falls outside the definition, we are not able to not to deal with it. Because it's not within the definition. And if the code is not wide enough, then members at that stage can take a decision whether they want to both discrimination and disability to have a specific definition. But what I'm saying is that at Netland, the feeling was that parties did not want to have a definition that would tend to narrow the concept of definition. They wanted as wide and an open possibility, and they felt that the code as it stands now cover that area effectively. There was this input by Professor De Tolt is not really questioning the amendment other than the omission that he believes that we should be defining discrimination. It's, as I said, it's the same as the one on disability. And also some partners were happy after the debate that it should remain as it is. As I've said, when we debate it clause by clause, members debate it clause by clause, we'll make sure that members have got the code so that they can look it against that. And also they debate the areas around disability, they'll have the code and see whether the code goes far enough. Remember, the law says that all practitioners that apply the law, they've got to apply the law and interpret the law in taking into consideration the codes and guidelines that are developed and passed by the minister, including the issue of conventions, international conventions and international obligations. And that's the intention of the parties at NELEC around this area. And I've already dealt with the issue of disability. It falls under the same realm also. It's not defined in terms of LRA, but there's a code that gives that broadens and take it up. And again, our worry is that we don't want to have a definition in terms of law that could be narrow. We want to have a wider meaning of disability as possible, so that if there is anything, you don't have to amend the law to cater for a definition, a disability that, for whatever reason, is not catered by that definition. And things change in the labor market. Things change also. Therefore, you don't want a situation around this area where people will be disadvantaged because the definition is not wide enough to cater for them. And that's the part is both on definition and on disability and on discrimination. The next area is about Section 6 on the provision of unfair discrimination. The concerns here were raised by the CLICS group, the company CLICS, which are City and Solidarity. Also around two areas. In clause 6, remember we putting an extra ground. There are little ground in the law as it stands, race, gender, disability, pregnancy, sex, and all of those issues. They have little grounds in Section 6. And it was agreed by parties at NETLAG that we need to include another ground, which is arbitrary ground. Both these submissions are putting a point that we should not be tampering with the listed grounds. And then both the submission, their intention is not to deal, our intention, I mean, our differences between NELEC parties and these parties is that NELEC parties believe that all sources of discrimination, whether they are listed or not listed, if you can show that that's discrimination, you should be able to have remedies on it. This part is here is that they would want to have as narrow as possible and confined area of discrimination. That's the major differences between the two parties. Therefore, they are of the view that the listed ground are narrow enough for them. When you include arbitrary ground, you widen the listed ground into including other possible areas of discrimination that parties could use to challenge discrimination. That's the first thing about this. And their argument is that the listed ground are enough to cater for all sorts of discrimination. Now, for us, is that, and the parties of network, is that if a white female is being discriminated against another white female, because of the law now, they can't take up the case. Because the grounds that are listed is race, in that case it's not race, is gender. Gender is not female against female, it's female against male. You can only use gender between the two in terms of existence now. And the court has interpreted that if I'm an African male and I'm being discriminated against another African male, in terms of the decisions that are taken by courts, in interpreting the listed ground, I'm not going to be able to take up a case on discrimination on the basis because the listed grounds do not cover me. And that's what arbitrary grounds would be able to give me as an African male against another African male whom I believe I'm being discriminated against. And that's what this invention is trying to do. And their view then is that it is widening up areas of possible challenges around discrimination. That's the best area that they're putting on. And their view also is that the listed grounds, this one, are in line with the listed grounds in Section 9 of the Constitution. Therefore, when you make this change, you are amending the Constitution. And in our view is that, look, in terms of the Constitution, we do not think that the intention of the Constitution was to limit the grounds for discrimination in such a sense that even if you two African male you discriminate on those basis, you should not be able to challenge that case. And in any event, the law as we put it now is such that if I allege discrimination on arbitrary ground, I must show why it is discrimination. The onus is on me. If you look at that act of the proposal now, there are two onus of proof, two elements. Where I allege discrimination on the listed ground, the onus is on the employer to show that there was no discrimination. It's not on the alleger. When I allege discrimination on the arbitrary ground, the onus is on me to show that discrimination. And that's how we balance it as the parties that make around this area. But I think the fundamental difference is between us and the parties that do not want these two areas, this area, is that we believe, and the parties of NetLink have agreed on this, that we should interpret the law as what is possible to deal with all forms of discrimination. If it's discrimination, we should be able to deal with it. We can't hide discrimination around the grounds that are listed. The other party believes that when you do that, you are opening the ground, and we believe that you should either rather err on the side of dealing with discrimination than not dealing with it. That's a major issue and difference between us and the party, and we do not believe that it raises any constitutional issues around this area. The next area around also this issue of discrimination, which is linked to this, is around the issue of equal pay, work of equal value, in relation again to Section 6, 6.1 and 6.4 of the amendment, which deal with the same issues of equal pay, work of equal value. And what we're saying is that they are saying, I think, Rotocom, Institute of Race Relations, KISS, and HRCT, that the insertion of 6.4 of the amendment which deal with the difference in terms of condition of employment between employee and so of the same work, equal work or equal work of pay, is already catered in the law. We don't have to make an amendment to specify specific deal with this issue. That's the issue that they are raising. And they believe that the criteria set in 6.1 already cater for this. Now, if let us go to the judgment that we got in there of the labor court that deals with management and others, Mariana and others, where the judge explained that the difficulties that various judges have in interpreting the concept of equal work, equal pay for work of equal value, for in the absence of a specific mentioning of that concept in the LRA, in the Employment Equity Act. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the IMO itself has been asking the country in our report and say, you've got to have a specific clause that deal with this area in the legislation. Therefore, for us, we don't think that the grounds that are listed in Section 6.1 are enough to deal with the area. And the courts have pronounced on it. It's not a legal issue. They are not saying that there's anything unconstitutional, illegal about what we put in, but they are saying, again, it's a principle of broadening or widening it, of clarifying it. They are saying, you don't have to do it because the 6.1 already caters for it. They are not saying that it's illegal. They are not saying it's unconstitutional. They are not saying it's drafted badly. They are saying Section 6.1 already caters for it. But we've judged it that says it doesn't. We've got the International Labour Organization that says it doesn't. And that's what we're answering. The second area that they are raising is that in Section 5, the bill gives ministers the power to publish guidelines on how would the department and the inspectors interpret deals anomalies in income differential. What is it that they are going to be looking to decide? Remember, the law doesn't say that there should be no anomalies in terms of income differential, because we could be doing the same job, but I'm good at what I'm doing. I use the public service. If you perform at the higher standard, you get bonuses, you get progression, all of those things in public service. If the next person is not performing, they are not going to get those things. Therefore, the wages are not going to be the same, although for the same service. That is acceptable. Now, this clause here is saying the minister must, through MEDLEC, give guidelines on how would this process of equal work or equal pay work. And it's a tool that will be used by business, by labor, so that they can understand how to interpret this area. We don't understand, therefore, the issue that they are raising, that the minister would have too much for a place on the minister in terms of deciding on this matter. Remember, regulation and guidance by the minister are only done through MEDLEC. Therefore, it's going to be business and labor after discussion that all of this takes place, that the minister will be able to issue those guidelines. And this is what this section is saying. And they are saying it's too much power that you're giving to the minister to ask the minister to introduce guidelines that will assist parties implementing this section. And it's, again, not a legal issue, but we do not believe on one side that it is issue about power. It's about bad practice. It's about assisting parties in terms of being able to interpret the legislation. And in any event, as we said, this will be done through MEDLEC. We've already established that process in anticipation of the bill becoming law, because when the bill becoming law, we should be ready for all with all these guidelines and these processes. And there's already started discussion at MEDLEC around this area with all parties. And the minister will publish those guidelines for comment by all interested parties. The next area on discrimination that we concern that has been raised is our Section 8D. This section is a section where presently the law said that any test that is done should be not be subjective, it should be scientific, it should be tested. Now, over the years, we had a lot of queries from employers. Employers owning the department themselves, we've got a process, we're going to be taking our employees through psychometric testing. can you certify as a department that this test is correct? It can be done. It meets Section 8D. And we have this problem because, remember, in the department, we're not experts around the issues of psychometric testing and all of those. We do not have those experts. We are not able to say to employers, no, yes, you can do the test. No, you can't do that test. You cannot do that test. Because we do not have those expertise. This is intended to clarify that. And there's only one body in the country, in terms of the law, that is allowed to do that test, which is the HPCSA, which is set up in terms of the law. Now, in this area, we've got two comments. One, by this body itself, the HPCSA, where they were saying in their comment that they want to be able to delegate this function to somebody else. The law, remember the amendment that is in front of you now, says they've got the responsibility. But they came here, they said that they want to delegate. We don't know for why. In our interacting with them, and the reason we, and also they were questioning two things, that they should be able to delegate, and they do not like the provision that says that the HPSSA or anybody authorized by any law. And for us, the reason we say that last part, that any law, we don't want that if the law that set up HPSA is changed in the parliament and another body is set up, then we must amend this law to make to put the name of that body. When you say the HPSA or any other body authorized by law, you're covering that area, that you don't have to amend the law every time it changes around the law that set up that body. That's the reason. If we've explained it to them, you know, that they have said, we don't think that is an issue. Because there's only one law presently that deals with that, if it's, and we're catering for the eventuality if it does change. Or if there's any other law that will introduce that, they would know, we'll all interact and through the public process. We believe that, but it's up to the members, that we don't think that input is warranted. That's the first thing. The issue of them having the right to delegate, we don't see that it's the responsibility of this law to give them authority whether they should delegate or not. The law that says them deals with that. For us is that it gives authority to that institution to do the testing. If they ask another organization to do the testing, as long as for us they then receive the report and endorse that report, it's done by them. We're not going to be able, nobody's going to be able to say it should, they cannot outsource, they cannot give it to a private organization, a psychologist company, to test it. That's not the intention of this legislation. Therefore, that's what they were fearing. They were fearing that the way it's put, it would mean that they've got to do it themselves. They can't allocate something else to another position. We do not interpret it on those bases. The next area that is raised around this area is those who are opposed to that. Remember, you had two presentations around with them. There are those who came in, especially the South African, what is it, South African, what, the SINOPSA, which is the psychology organization, who were saying HPCSA is incompetent, is not qualified, it does not deliver, therefore don't give them this work. Basically, that's what they were saying. And for us, in terms of our law, if the law says that this test must be tested, the only organization that is set in terms of law to do that is this. If that organization is not able, we need to sort out that problem. It's a different problem, the issues of capacity, the issue of them still able to do their job. They got to deal with that issue and try and deal with that. And the discussion of whether assessment and test that they're talking about, they were saying that does it mean now that if we interview, if you're in parliament, you want the secretary and you interview me for that post, is that a test? And we think that those debates should be taken by experts in the council that deals with these issues. As layperson around this field, I don't think interviews are tests in the first place. If a manager interview a worker to ascertain whether they've got the capability to do the job, we don't think that's the intention of the law that it has. But we think that the people that are best placed it's them, the psychologists and the people who are doing this job, and the council who must have that discussion and decide what is it. If they say it's a test, and they believe it's a test, then for us it's good enough, then it's a test. If they say it's not a test, we are not going to be able to do that. And that's why the law is not defining what the test is, because it won't leave it to expert itself to deal with this issue. The other issue that they raise here is the fact that now we're giving the CCMA authority. Remember, I said there are two groupings. The main differences with us, with many of these organizations, is that from the left constituency, they want to broaden and deal with discrimination. These organizations want to narrow it. The major constituencies want to resolve disputes quickly. These organizations would want to drag it as much as they can. Now, here they say, no, don't send it to the CCMA. They are disagree with giving the CCMA the jurisdiction to deal with discrimination matters. And they believe that the only institution that can deal with this issue is the Labour Court. Now, this is not a legal issue. It's an issue about perception and the preference of the institution. We believe that the CCMA is more accessible. We believe that the CCMA has got offices in all the provinces of the country, that the Labour Court are differently. And we believe that on cases of discrimination, the CCMA will be more sensitive to these cases than the Labour Court. And there's been an agreement on NEDLAC on these issues. And there's no constitutional issues about this issue. Now, the other issues that they are raising, they believe that the CCMA commissioners are not going to be able to interpret constitutional law and issues around these areas. We do not believe that. If you look on the case around Sidumo, it started the CCMA. It ended up in the Constitutional Court. And the Constitutional Court in that case agreed with the Commission. And I'm roughly stating one case where the Constitutional Court disagreed with the Labour Appeal Court, agreed with the Commissioner, the interpretation of the Commissioner on the issues around Sidumo. It shows the capacity of Commissioners in the CCMA. And there's also the issue about person vis-a-vis parties. I mean, there's the issue that Section 10.5 talk to person and natural person. This issue is not here nor there. I mean, the concept of a person, when you're talking about a person and a natural person, you're talking about, you cover all bases. There's no way that you talk about a person and exclude any other. They are making a point that it might exclude natural people, natural person not affected on this. We do not understand that. You've got two sort of persons in the law. You've got natural person, you've got person. And when you talk about a person, you already know, and we do not think this is an issue at all. And it wouldn't exclude anybody in terms of these areas. Now, the areas also that they were raising is that they are not happy with the fact that, remember, in the discrimination we said that if you earn below the DA threshold, you can approach the CMA. And then said that if you put a case around sexual harassment, irrespective of how much you earn, you can approach the CCMA, not the Labour Court. Those are the two exceptions. Now, this organization, they were asking, raising the issue here that we should not be doing this issue. And our explanation is here, with the amount of children abuse, sexual abuse in the country, and I think we've got the highest in the world around this area. This area should be treated differently. And that's the only reason that parties at NEDLAC, all of them, business and labor, agree that cases around sexual harassment and sexual abuse in the workplace should also go to the CCMA, purely because they need to be solved speedily. Because when you expose the abused in a long process, in certain cases, with abusers still working in the company because the case is not finalized, it could have long-term effects. The issue of, again, Professor Darcy, on Section 11, made the suggestion that Section 6.2 should be amended to read such as alleged definition is justifiable in terms of Section 6.2. We believe this area, members, is already covered in the amendment. If we look on the amendment, Section 6.2, Section 6.2, I'll read it. It says, if unfair discrimination is alleged on arbitrary grounds, the complaint must prove on balance of probabilities that it goes on in terms of the issues. Now, the intention of 6.2, first, is to include a separate ground from the licit ground. Okay? Therefore, when you bring it back to the listed ground, as he's suggesting, saying that 11B should be included, we believe that's covered already. If you read 11B, it says, you see the problem is that when you read 11B, you must read the whole section. That's the first thing. If you read, you want to say unfair discrimination is alleged on a ground listed in section 6.1. It's already there. He says that you want to add listed in section 6.2 of this act. It's already there, included. It's alleged in section 6.1 instead of 6.2. And believe that if you are going to add it to section 6.2, then you're diluting the intention of this amendment, because this amendment wants to take 6.2 out of the 6.1 grounds. It wants to introduce an arbitrary ground which is not listed in 6.1. Now, when you refer it back to 6.2, that you're creating that confusion. And we think that all the issues that he has raised are covered in terms of the law. There are no issues that we need to correct here, but the members will have to look at it when we debate the issue. Now, on the issues of enforcement, these are areas of enforcement where BUSA, Business South Africa, was concerned about. They are of the view that when you look at Section 16 and Section 17, you cannot define for both of them. Basically, that's what they are saying. If you, Section 16 deals with the issues on consultation, Section 17 deals with issues on matters for consultation. Section 16 deals with consultation and 17 with matters for consultation. Now, if you look at the Act, it says, the fine section of the Act, it says Section 16 read with Section 17. Therefore, it means that if you find in Section 16, you would find in Section 17, because it's the same thing, you read it together. That's what the amendment says. It says Section 16 read with Section 17 already. Now, we're not sure what is it that they are raising, because there can't be double penalties there, because you read it together on the issue. Therefore, we don't understand the issue that business is raising. We don't think that they look at the fine as they are. The next area that BUSA is raising about enforcement, they are opposed to direct referral in the labor court. And their view is that if the only time that they can refer, they can agree to refer to the labor court is if compliant is removed. Now, what they mean about this is that on the areas about a plan, they want to only refer a company that does not have a plan to the labor court. If a company has got something like a plan, they've got the two-page that's written a plan, or half-page written a plan, and when you look at that plan against the requirement of Section 20, and you believe that plan only cover one area of Section 20, they say that company should not be taken straight to the labor court, because they say it's an interpretation of whether the plan complies with the law or not. That's the issue that they are raising. For us, we say, look, Even if it's a matter of interpretation, we should go to the labor court. The court will tell us if we're wrong. If this claim complies with Section 20, the court will be able to say it does comply with Section 20. Now, that's what they're saying. They're saying where the plan is, you don't have a plan, then go straight to the labor court. Where you do have the plan, but the plan is not compliant with Section 20, you should not go to the labor court. And that's the issue that they're raising here. And that's the issue that we disagree with. And we do not see the difference. And the plan must cover areas that the law says it must cover. If it doesn't cover those areas, it's good as not having the plan. Their argument is that if the plan covers two of the areas in Section 20, it's better than not having the plan. And we are on the opposite side. It's not a legal issue. There's nothing about that is wrong with the law. It's about also, again, they want a situation where we will say, well, your plan does not cover this section. Now we're not taking you to the labor court. We are going to give you a compliance order that says your plan must comply with the law. That's what they're asking. We're not going to the labor court. We must give you a compliance order that says, sir, your plan must comply. But I'm saying, but the law already says that. The law as it stands is a compliance order. It says the plan must comply with Section 20. And that's basically the issue that they are raising. Now, the next issue that they are raising here is direct, that's a referral to the labor court on this area. Now, on Section 21, APSA, CAPES, and HRCT proposed that Section 21 deal with reporting. Presently, we've got a provision that says that small business must report every 2 years. Big business, which employ more than 50, must employ every year. We propose in Section 21 that the reporting period must be one. All of them must report once every year. And there are two reasons for this. Small business presently report on a yearly basis, not because the law requires them to report. They report because many of them want to tender for work in government. For them to be able to tender to work in government, they got to have a BE certificate. A BE certificate deal with employment equity side of it. Now, if they do not report, they are not going to get the BE certificate. Now, you've got a situation where the law says these companies must not report, and they flood, they come in and report. They insist that they will need to report, because if you don't take their report, you're taking them out of business. That's the first thing. The second thing is that when we initially started with employment equity reporting, the form constituted of about 26 pages. We've relooked at the forms. The forms now is about 12 pages. We've reduced the pages to 12. We intend to even go further and reduce the pages. We intend to capture all the information that is the standard in the form so that employers don't have to recapture. It's just like if you register in SAS, you want that good practice of SAS. Well, if when you go, you submit your tax return, those that submit tax return. Thank you, Honorable. You go into online reporting. you go to online reporting. The online reporting of SAS gives you your details automatically. It gives you all your information. Then you've got to change it somewhere where you need to change it. The changes that you need to make, it's up to you if you need to. But it gives you the information, and that's what we're doing. We want a system that will give the employers that information, the information that they supply. If a company has reported, the form will give them the information that they reported last year. Say, this is what reported last year. Are there any changes that you want to make? And then we'll make those changes. And therefore, with the steps that we've taken, we do not believe that there's still a necessity for separate reporting dates. First, from employers themselves, that's what they were asking. Secondly, because of the system that we've built in, we do not think that this arrangement is necessary anymore. And This is accepted by BUSA themselves, I mean, who represent this organization ethnically, because they understand the system that we're talking about, the issues that we're talking about. BUSA is not raising this as an issue at all. They've accepted this. We do believe that it increases the burden to small business. This, it facilitates them to be able to access the market through this process. And when you ask all companies, just think of us saying this year, only big companies must pay tax and report on tax. You can't have that situation. And that's what we're trying. When we talk about transformation in the labor market, our report must cover for that year all the companies that must report, irrespective of whether they are small or big companies. But we accept that we should strive by all means to make it easy for all companies, not only small business, for all companies to report. And those are the things that we do. Maybe what the members need to do to specify themselves, they could ask us to come and do a presentation on the reporting, online reporting, how it works, the areas, because that's what we're doing. On the road shows that we are having now around the country, we take employers on online reporting. We can do that also to members of parliament and take them through so that they can understand the reporting arrangement and the forms, what they are asking, and what are the changes that we'll be making that we're busy with going forward for not this reporting period, for the next reporting period in the 12 pages that we have, what are other more changes that we're making. We can take members through that process. The next area also is around the issues of undertaking. We're making two changes on this area, Minister. Is that 36 and 37, first, we give the inspector discretion in securing an undertaking. We're saying inspectors must have the discretion. They don't have to secure an undertaking, but they may secure it. And we're going further on this area, members. Our enforcement manual is going to change. Although the law says they may obtain an undertaking, we are asking our inspectors to, at all instances, obtain an undertaking, if it's possible. They must obtain an undertaking. Because it makes sense. When you read it against the other changes that we made, remember we said that now, the undertaking can be enforced as if it's a compliance order. An undertaking is an agreement that you enter into with. You say, I agree, I've contravened the law, I'm going to correct it by next week. If you don't do that, the inspector is able to take that undertaking in terms of the amendment that we've made and go to the labor court and say, here's an agreement that this employer has given to us. The employer has failed to meet the terms of this agreement. We want the court to enforce them to meet the terms. Therefore, we agree. All this, but we don't want a situation that says that if inspector deals with me and the inspector know my record that I never agree on anything. When I arrive there, I don't give any undertaking. Remember, undertaking is the inspector is begging me to agree. And they know. They've met with me last week, they've met with me that week because I'm a visitor here because of a record. And the law says that you must get an undertaking. When they know that we're going to get an undertaking here. If you go to the CCMA, the commissioner will tell you there are sectors that don't settle at the CCMA. It's their principle. Now, what we're saying is that inspectors, they should not be forced not to use their own judgment and say, in this company, it's going to be a waste of time to me to try and get an argument. Because this company was here last week on the same issue. Remember, inspectors deal with cases that are reported. They might on the same issue get a report on this, by this employee, in the same case by another employee. And that's the issue that we're raising. Why should we believe that it's in the interest of the inspector to get an undertaking? Because it's easier to enforce an undertaking. Because if you break an agreement, if you are a person if you're a man of honor, a person of honor, one breath, your word is your bond. If you say, I will do this, everybody expects you to do it. That's what an undertaking is. But if then you don't communicate that, the courts are not favorable to anybody who breaks agreement. The court respects agreement in this country. If you go in agreement, you do something and you don't do it, you are not likely going to go to the court and say, no, these are the reasons. The court is not going to listen. Therefore, that's why it's important for us to get an undertaking so that it's easy for enforcement. But at the same time, we're saying inspectors should not be confined to that. If for whatever reason they don't get an undertaking, the employer should not be going to court and say, well, I'm not going to argue here whether I owe this worker 20 rand. But I'm going to argue that this inspector did not obtain an undertaking from me. You have technicality. Because an inspector failed to obtain an undertaking. When you say must, an inspector failed to do that, then it means that when you go to the labor court, the argument is not going to be about whether did I pay this employee or not. The argument becomes, did the inspector try to obtain an undertaking? That's what we're taking out. That's the issue that we're taking out. Now, the other issue now that also business it does not agree on, even boost on this, is the removal of objection and appeal. Presently, the law has got four areas. The inspector must obtain an undertaking. If the employer refuses, then the inspector must give a compliance order. And if the employer doesn't comply after 60 days, then the employer could object to the compliance order. They say, I object to this compliance order. Then after objecting, the employer can say, I appeal against this compliance order. And only then can the inspector go to the labor court. Now, we say that's not necessary. The labor court is an appeal itself. If the inspector issues a compliance order, that compliance order is not impossible. Unless the employer agrees, the only mechanism to enforce that compliance order is a court. When an employer says that I'm issuing a compliance order, the employer can refuse to comply. That's not cause the employer to comply, compliance order on its own. But the decision of the court on that compliance order forces an employer to comply with the court order. Therefore, to say that you must still have an objection and appeal, and that's the issue here. And we believe that that's a very, very, very cumbersome process. But this does not mean, members, that as the business is arguing that your inspectors will take up unnecessary cases, let's say a case that should not be in the court. The inspector interpret the law wrongly and take it to the court. Now, their argument is that they need to be able to appeal and object to that compliance order so that it doesn't go to court. The Minister of Labour, the Director General of Labour, received thousands of letters as we speak. Nothing prevent any employer writing to the Minister and the Director General if the company believes that the inspector has misinterpreted the law. This thing is not going to work out, and they write to the Minister and the Director General and say, this is what we think about this case. The Minister is not going to throw away that letter. The Minister is going to send that letter through the chain. Might end up with me, might end up with Sam, might end up. And when we read it, if it makes sense. There are many cases where people withdraw cases on the court steps. We'll do that. It does not prevent employers writing to the Minister. His removal. That's what I'm trying to say. If they want to write to the Minister, if they believe that the inspector has taken a decision that they believe is not defensible in court, nothing prevents them approaching. Nothing prevents them approaching the provincial director in that office, going to the head of the office in, let's say, here in Cape Town, if the inspector here in Cape Town, and say, look, we don't think the inspector in Bellville understand the law. This is the case that we're fighting with. That those doors are open to all citizens of this country. You don't need a legal right, a law for that. When you write to the Minister, if the Minister doesn't respond, we know that it will come, it will end up with the committee if the Minister doesn't deal with those issues. The letter will be in the committee, will be. That's the nature of the labor market, and those things happen on a daily basis. That's not what this says. This says you can still do those issues if you want, but to confine enforcement. Remember, we're talking wages of workers here. This farm worker has not been paid his wages. The farm worker comes here, The inspector must give an undertaking, must give compliance order, there must be an objection, there must be an appeal. The person that is affected is not earning the salary. For a year, they must wait for all of these processes. And but if you approach the court immediately on these issues and deal with them speedily, it will assist these employees. Therefore, what we're asking them is they must look at it both ways. That speedy resolution, especially of these kinds of disputes, because they deal with livelihood of the most vulnerable of our workers. Now, Section 22 on compliance also, these organizations, including Vodacom, they are raising two issues. We are amending the law presently never says, in applying Section 42 of the law, the minister, any employer must take into consideration, this is a very controversial issue, solidarity, and all other parties are raising this issue, must take into consideration both national and regional demography. That's what the law says. Now, members, please tell me, help me. If an employer, I come here to this committee and ask, the law says I must take both regional and national demography. How do I do that? How do you, when the companies come to us and ask us, how do you take both national and regional into consideration when you apply the law? What answer would you give? We don't have an answer. We've been asked this question for the last 15 years, and we can't answer it presently. That's the first thing that we put in the law. That's what the law says presently. Now, what we put in the amendment, we put in amendment the provision that says the minister must assist us and inspectors and publish, not us and inspectors only, must assist inspectors, must assist employers, must assist all parties in the labor market and publish regulation that says under what circumstances should employer use regional demographics? Under what circumstances should they use national demographics? That's what Section 42 says, the amendment that we made. We don't change the both, still there as it is. But what we're saying, the minister must publish guidelines. Those guidelines will have to be debated at NetLeg, must publish for public comment, where the minister will say to employers, when you apply Section 42, national demographic, you must take these factors into consideration. The minister might say, I'm just using an example, might say, if you are a company that have got a national footprint, for example, it doesn't matter, it shouldn't matter where your head office is. If you've got a national footprint, you should be required to use national demographic. I'm using an example, I'm not saying that's what the minister will say, I'm just so that we can understand what we mean by these guidelines. The minister may say, if you are a regional, you've got a regional footprint, you're a small company in the region, you don't have any, although you might have markets anywhere, but you don't have a national proof footprint, you should be using regional demography. That's what the intention of this section is to explain this area clearly so that the minister should say, this is what we're advising. And this will be done through NetLeg. Now, the opposition from this organization is that they don't want anything to that effect that the minister should be given that power. That's the best thing. And we believe if we leave it as it is, we confusing the labor market unless somebody is able to give us that answer and say this is what the law means when it says use both, especially when it says use both regional and national. Does it mean use them at the same time, also at the same time? Does it mean use them this year, then the following year use this one? What does it mean when it says use both regional and national? And that's the dilemma that I'm trying to solve with the guidelines that we're talking about. Remember, it's guidelines or code or regulation that will publish whatever it is. That's what it's intended to do. The next area that business is not happy with is the area around Section 42. It's the area around Section 42. This is a very controversial area. We're making changes there. Business is saying Section 42 should remain the same, should not make changes in that area. Now, what are the changes that we want to make, members? I want to read so that members can understand exactly what we're changing. Section 42, as it stands now, says that when the Director General or any person or board applying this act must, in addition to the factors further stated in Section 15, the factors section in Section 15, that will not change it. Those factors are still there. Take into account all of the following. Now, it says, it must take into account the demographic profile of national and regional economic active population. That is, when inspector want to implement this law, must first say, take what is the demographic and national and regional economic active population. We don't have a problem with that. And then it says, the inspector must look on the pool of suitably qualified people from designated group from which the employer may reasonably be expected to promote or appoint employees. It says that you must take into account, are there enough accountants in the labor market or any other skills before you enforce this law? What we're saying is this. It should not be the responsibility of an inspector to take that into account. It should be the employer that says, the reason I'm not able to meet the requirement of my plan is because they are not suitably qualified people and all of those issues. Remember the plan. In plan, you must select barriers. You must identify barriers. If in your plan you have not identified that they are not enough skill, then you can't use that as a reason for not transforming. Because your plan must identify and say, what will make him not to be able to reach my target? If you have not said they are not enough skill, you can't say that issue is an issue. And the same act says that, when you identify a barrier, if you say as a company, I need to transform, but the reason for me not to transform, not to be able to transform is because there are not enough skills, then the law says, your plan must say, what are you going to do about that? Now, if you set up, say, a five-year plan, say, in 5 years, I want to transform this company to be the 20% representative. But for me to reach that 20% representative, I need five accountants. I'm not able to get 5,000 female accountants now. If I don't have them here, you look in the labor market, you say, okay, what is it that you're going to do to be able to get that? There are two issues. You can go to the universities in your area and say, what is the rate of people that are in? Who can I sponsor and tie them to the company for them to come and work in the company in 5 years' time because of my sponsorship? That's the intervention that you make here. Now, when you say inspector before they enforce the law, they must take those issues into consideration. It just doesn't make sense for us. We're taking that away. We say employer can use it if they want to use it in the labor court and say it's because they're not enough. The next area that this act says our inspectors must check the economic and financial factors relevant to the sector in which the employer operates. And then we say, why should the inspectors be burdened by checking the economic and financial condition of companies? It's for companies to come up and argue and say, well, our company is not doing very well. I don't know, inspectors are not, I mean, you're talking about inspectors, I cannot even do that. I mean, it's even difficult to read the balance sheets of these companies by very learned people. I mean, accountants make mistakes in this issue. Now we're saying to inspectors, before they use Section 32, they've got to make sure that they understand the economic and financial sector relevant to the sector. We say no. This burden, if you put this, no inspector will be able to enforce this law. And then it says the inspector must consider the number of vacancies planned by the company. Now, it's for the company to say that we plan to fill our vacancies, but we do not have any vacancies. But the inspector can say, before we look at your performance, we must check how many vacancies did you have. And those are the changes that we're making. We're saying all of these things that make it impossible for inspectors. You ask the inspector to be economist, and that's not the intention of the inspector. If employers want to go and argue and the court accepts that as a valid argument, then let the court decide on that. Let the court decide that. But it cannot be put in as a stumbling block in front of the sector. That's what he's saying. Therefore, this issue is not a legal issue. This is an issue on, I mean, for us it's an issue how can we speed up transformation. Business is an issue of how can there is no transformation down. Anything that can make it difficult for inspectors to enforce the law, business would want it in the act. And that's why they, around these issues, are very, very, very vocal around this area of Section 42 enforcement. Now, on penalties, it's not about also law. I mean, this is about turnover. Business has one nothing linked to turnover. They want basically nothing linked to turnover. And they say if you put turnover, you're going to bankrupt us. But you say, I mean, you say, if you comply with the law, you've got nothing to fear. And I mean, the worst part of this law, it's not as if that this law says the department must set up quotas. It doesn't say employers, these employers, these are the quotas. It doesn't say that. This law says come with a plan. Come with a plan and implement that plan. Now, if I'm a CEO of a company and the board says to me, come with a plan to capture 10% of the market share, and I don't do that, shouldn't the board be able to dismiss it? And business is saying, no, that's too draconian. You shouldn't be able to be dismissed because you have not implemented your plan. The law says come, you give your own plan and you fail to implement it, you want now the court to levy the handover on you because it's your own plan. Now, what's the issue? Now, these are the issues. These issues are because it's not about the law. It's, for us, it's about how effective the law should be. For business, it's about is what is it that you can put to make sure that the law does not go forward. Now, it's for members to decide which side in that phase they're going to be. And the turnover starts from 2%. It's not 10%. It starts from 2%, it ends 10%. The company that will get 10% is a company that has not complied this year, not complied the following year, not complied again and again and again. And this takeover will be levied by the court, not by the inspector. It's a court that will say that. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Those are the issues we've tried to cover, all of them.
Thank you for the responses. That's very detailed, Mr. Mukalibi. Thank you very much. I feel that I was at the public hearings. I feel I haven't missed anything. I only remember there's the presentation, are there comments and all. Of course, there would be other things that you say that the legal team still need to reformulate and formulate other, you know, things. Let's check Honorable Khanare, the Bush lawyer.
Yeah. I'm keeping my powder dry.
Mark your man.
He has got a very difficult task.
It's a very difficult one.
Yeah. Because he doesn't know what he's marking. There are two issues which I wanted clarity on. You kept on talking about definitions, né? And about whether they are good, they can either be good or bad, and here the issue of definitions arose again. But doesn't the definition also bring certainty? And if you look at it in that way, doesn't it solve a lot of problems when there is certainty as far as the law is concerned? The other point is that under Section 20, your response is that you are in discussion with Labour Court to ensure that this kind of case will be prioritized. There are two things. The first one is the independence of the judiciary, whether Labour Court doesn't fall within the judiciary and whether it's not independent anymore. And secondly, if you participate, I don't know how are you going to participate in ensuring that the case gets prioritized without being part of the administration of that particular court. And if they don't prioritize these cases, if in terms of their own politics, within the labor court. They don't prioritize the cases which you think should have been prioritized. Do you have any other alternative?
I marked him. I knew that he was going to ask what he has asked. I know why. It's because he was not part of the public hearings. I think it's fine. Calypso can, because the area that I wanted to comment on is what he has just asked. I don't seem to have an impression that I'm responding on behalf of the department. Come to them, Khalid.
You should just have said, you took the words out of my mouth.
I'll talk to them in Khalid. That's a good one.
From the members. Oh yeah, I know it's a prayer time for him. Yeah.
My old professor would say, "Che, it's just get us mad with 35 things."
Got it.
Che and honourable members, on this issue of definition, I mean, this is what you're saying. Our view, definition, we're not adverse to definition because all our legislation have got definitions. They define. The only thing that we're saying is that we must be careful. Sometimes definition tend to narrow issues. They can be helpful, yes, I agree. And the only thing that we're saying for us and the NetLeg stakeholders on these areas, especially the areas about discrimination, because the areas about disability was not debated at NetLeg. It came out in the public hearing. And in that area, the only thing that we're saying is that when making that decision, we've got to be careful that in definition, yes, definition can be good sometimes, give certainty, they clarify the issues, but sometimes they narrow the issues in that clarification of the issues of bringing certainty. They narrow, making it difficult. If any other form of discrimination arises that is not within the definition, then your case could be argued purely on technicality that it doesn't fall within that definition. It's not what is defined in terms of law. That's the issue that we're trying to. And what we're saying is that let's put, when the members debated this issue close to close, we will make sure that, I mean, when we arrive this week in the office, make sure that the members have got a copy of the codes that through this issue, how they deal with the issues. And if members are saying that the code is not going far enough, because so far the code on discrimination, there has been no single party except this amendment that has argued that the understanding of definition of discrimination by the courts, by the CCMA, by institution is not good enough. You need this kind of definition. And if that's what the members are saying, the only thing we're raising is that just we've got to be wary of narrowing the scope of discrimination. The wider the scope of discrimination is, the better for society. That argument that we're making. On the issue of discussion in the Labour Court, if you look on the amendment of the LRA first, we make an amendment to the LRA to make sure that the rules board of the Labour Court function properly, meets properly. And that's our interaction with the rules board of the management of the court through the rules board. Secondly, we interact with management of the court, not the court decision, not influencing the court decision. The management of the courts, it's not the judge's responsibility to put case on the roll, you know, that's the management. And most of these cases where there is, let us say you've got an agreement, you sign an undertaking and you do not comply with it, goes to the labor court. Those are the kind of cases that courts should be able to deal with fast. The cases around compliance orders that are not not implemented. Those are the in our discussion, for example, is that we have a discussion with the court that says that the court will every second week in their role have a day for compliance order. And for compliance order that come before that, the court, everybody would know that there will be compliance order in the Capital Labour Court dealing with compliance order on that day. That has come in the last month. And if the court could put it in their program to deal with those issues, as if you're dealing with them on an opposed basis, on those basis, and it's only when complication arises in the case that the judge would say, okay, let's postpone this case for later. But those are kind of ideas that we've had, that we've raised with the court. Secondly, at NEDLAC, the Labour Market Chamber, have got an agreement with the Chief Justice of the Labour Court, the President, not the Chief, the President of the Labour Court, of the Labour Court, that we meet with him every 3 months for stakeholders to raise whatever issues that they think that they need to raise, backlog in the Labour Court. It's about administration of the court. And those are arrangements that we will use to ensure that this process, and the justice has agreed to give stakeholders at NEDLAC a report on how the court deals with backlog, with cases that are there, what cases are there, and all of those issues. Therefore, there are already arrangements, as I said, through the rules, but through the interaction at NEDLAC with the church president, and this discussion that we're having. There was already an arrangement, I think, in the Western Cape, if I'm making a second, on this issue of compliance order, having days set up for compliance order. And it's normal that courts do that when they know that they've got many of these cases coming up, that you set up a day saying, we'll be dealing with this case on this day. And that those ideas will be discussed with the Labour Court. The Labour Court, as all of us, is interested in social justice, is interested to ensure that cases are resolved speedily. And in those cases where there's no complication, they wouldn't have a problem dealing with these issues on the basis that we're facing.
And thanks for referring to social justice, because it's very important. You know, discrimination, if you define it narrowly, it may leave other things out. I just learned some few years ago that over-condescending is another form of discrimination. Some people may see it differently. But if the burden is on me to prove to the court that I was discriminated against, I was treated unfairly and unfairly because of this practice, I think somebody can be able to prove it. So I'll just add into that thing that dictionary interpretations of this can be very limited. Okay. Are there issues that the numbers would like to raise? No, Williams is
I'm covered, thank you.
No, he's thinking about what is happening next week. With this, let me take this opportunity to say thank you to the presenters from the department. Thank you, Baya Dangi, Ken Seal, Rore Wangamandazin. The members of the committee will remain. We've got some few administrative things to deal with. Minutes, the program, and others. I promise you we're not going to take more than 15 minutes to deal with this issue. This meeting adjourns, except for us, for the members of the committee.
Okay, no.
Yeah, let's leave that. Let's look at the minutes of the minutes of the 14th of August. Are you on that page? You don't have to leave now if you don't want to leave. We are not discussing spirits. page 1, page 2. Page 3. Are there issues for members? Any movement for adoption?
I move for adoption.
The member is supported by brothers. And then
Chairperson,
will be the.
I'm not questioning the correctness of these minutes, but may I just ask? At the bottom of page 2, it says there, the chairperson submitted the draft minutes, which were considered and adopted. I want to suggest that we either say adopted without any changes, or adopted as is, or adopted with the following amendments, but that we just say that they were, or that they were adopted, you know, as correct, something like that. It's nothing serious. But I just want to I think it will be an improvement if we say whether we found them in order. And again, I think you know that we are actually quite complimentary about the standard of our minutes and the correctness thereof.
Yeah.
Thank you.
If you look at the last page, it says which was considered and adopted with amendments. Oh, the program, okay. No, that's a good one, thank you. Minutes, I'm half far away. I guess Mook, this was a Mook. Yeah, I think you'll do that because this minutes were, there were no amendments and all those. So you write it correctly. Draft report of the Portfolio Committee on Labour on an unannounced visit to the Cape Town and Yanga Labour Centres, 23rd July. I got my report some days ago. I don't know if somebody see the other such in the report for the first time now.
Let's say, get a briefing from the internal audit
committee on the performance of the compensation. When we're in Pretoria at the head office, I talked to some lady who is the internal audit person, and she was raising issues that I thought would be helpful, you know, us as the committee to hear that. They've been trying to advise the compensation and people are not listening to them. I think this would be very important for us to get this presentation here. Okay. If it's in order, we will, when the slot arises, I was even suggesting that we do it on the 17th September. On that day, we were supposed to be having a joint session with the BC on agriculture and fishing. And I think we can have it on the 18th, that is the following day, because we'll be going, yeah. So, if it... The 18th is Wednesday. We can meet them on Tuesday, 2 o'clock between 2 and 7. Or let's say if there are no changes in terms of the bigger picture in Parliament, this date will be confirmed with members.
Chairperson, may I just express my gratitude for this? Last week when we had the training with the AG, they actually encouraged us to engage with the internal audit functions of the entities as well. And I'm not sure if it was the internal audit or the external audit committee. Was it the internal audit? But the fact that you're acting so swiftly on this issue is very good to be appreciated. Thank you.
Leadership of the, what do they call them, audit committees, because they too have their own story to tell. And the idea is we would like to turn the quiet around. I'm sure this year is going to get a very, very negative comment by the opinion, by the AG. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.